Chapter 55. By the time Travertine fell back into orbit around Orizon, the lander had been restocked and made ready for the descent to Eunice's old encampment. Goma and Rue travelled with Hector, squeezed into the pressurized bay alongside the hammock suspended Risen, while Vazin handled the descent, a much easier proposition than landing on the wheel, and one which he handled with a certain casualness. Accompanying them were Kanu, Dr. Andiza, Peter Grave and Carrion, and the body of Eunice Akinia. She had been autopsied in orbit. Nothing in Andiza's examination contradicted Namejo's original findings, although she made a few discoveries of her own, quirks of anatomy and genetics that betrayed the handiwork of her alien makers, any one of which would have provided sufficient scholarly interest for an entire academic career. Andiza debated with Goma and Vazin about the best way to deal with the body, whether they were being negligent by taking it down to Orizon to be buried with the other Risen, and were in fact obliged to put it into Skipover and return it to human civilization.
"You have your scans, your autopsy," Goma said without rancor, for she fully understood Andiza's concerns.
She was a scientist too, not so different from Goma.
"Some DNA and tissue samples, some blood. I'm afraid they're the best you're going to get."
"This is the way it has to be, Mona."
She expressed a clear wish to be buried with a Risen.
"According to Kanu," Goma said.
"Then we must honor that wish." Before they landed, they had already made contact with the human skeleton staff, left behind after the last visit. Goma, Rue, and Vazin suited up and walked from the lander to the camp's entrance, passing the stone burial mounds on their way. The remaining Tantors, Atria, Mimosa, Cade, and Eldersich, had been forewarned about Eunice's death. Goma nonetheless felt that she had a duty to share the message again in person. In their underground rooms, she and Rue sat and talked for long hours, recounting their memories of Eunice. Death was never mentioned, out of respect for the custom of their hosts. Goma and Rue spoke only of Eunice passing into the remembering, and they stressed that hers had been a good and brave passing. It was hard to read the Risen, even now. They appeared satisfied with this account of things, but Goma could not guess at the errors she had made, the myriad small hurts she must have inflicted. All her old knowledge of elephants and tantors felt obsolete in the presence of these bold new creatures, with heads full of language and time.
"There is another," she said, judging that the moment was right. "Hector is his name. He was with Dakota. I know that makes him your enemy after everything that happened between you and Zanzibar, but Hector's on his own now."
"Is he here?"
Atria asked. Goma nodded.
"In the lander. I wanted to see how you felt before we arranged for him to come here."
"You may bring him,"
Cade decided.
"We will wait."
It took 3 hours to arrange this first meeting between the two factions of the Risen, after their long sundering. It was an uneven congress, Goma had to admit. Four of them, one of him. At first, all were trepidatious, as nervous and hesitant in their way as any wild elephants would be on encountering unfamiliar herd members. But the awkwardness passed, trunks were intertwined, the Risen began to speak to Hector. Hector replied. It was clear to Goma that they had much to talk about. She wondered what she was witnessing in those first moments of cordiality. She hoped it was the beginning of something. A keystone on which the Risen could start the difficult work of becoming a viable line again. She could not count on finding the Tantors of Zanzibar any time soon, if they were recontacted within her lifetime. But they would make the best of what they had, with the best that their genetic science and wisdom could do for these 5 individuals. Doubtless, there would be many setbacks. It would be ominous if there were none.
but they had come so far, all of them. They were due some luck. She allowed herself an optimistic thought.
Let the risen make the best of what they are, and let us all find the best in each other, humans and risen.
People both. She did not think there could be any harm in that. Meanwhile, there was work to do. Under the best set of assumptions, it would be weeks before Travertine was in any kind of position to commence its return journey to Crucible. Vazin had confided that months would be a more realistic estimate, and that it might be wise to assume they could be here for a year, even two. They still had to source fuel for the initializing tanks, and that would mean a much more thorough exploration of the system's outer worlds than they had yet undertaken. Besides having come this far, it was senseless to rush home. There was still the other mandala to be explored in detail, and there was even some rash talk of possibly attempting to initiate another mandala event. If the mirrors could be made to work again, they were still in orbit, then there was no compelling reason why Eunice's work could not be replicated. Travertine could put a small probe in orbit, an instrument package with a long-range antenna. After the event, they would have some idea of the direction in the sky from which to await a response. Rasher still, Goma even heard talk of possibly doing the same thing with the lander, with people aboard. Volunteers, of course. Since they could not count on finding mirrors at the other end, it would of necessity be a one-way trip into the interstellar unknown. But if the circumstances of Eunice's event could be exactly duplicated, the lander might be sent to the same location as Zanzibar. They had promised they would come looking, after all. Strange to think that wherever Zanzibar had gone, it was still on its way from her perspective. That would be true for years, decades, centuries to come. But in the time frame of Memphis and the other risen, no more than an instant would separate their experience of being in this system from suddenly being somewhere else. In that sense, they were already there. Goma marvelled at that thought. She wondered what the old, slow Tantor was seeing now, through the dark scrutiny of his wise and patient elephant eyes. Something truly worthy of his interest, she hoped. It would be good to find out, one day. She vowed that she would never look at the stars and not think about Memphis, not until there was news of Zanzibar.
If there was a faster way to get you to Earth, I would jump on it, Vazin said. But we have to go via Crucible, I'm afraid. Even if we had enough confidence to trust Travertine to that alien contraption, we still couldn't send you to Earth. Mandala to mandala. That's the only way we know. We get the stepping stones, but not the choice of where they're located.
For now.
Granted. And maybe we'll learn more, if and when we get anywhere at all. But that's for the future. When you get to Crucible, I'll petition the government to allow us to make a rapid crossing to Earth space.
If there's still a government?
Goma said.
There's that, yes. But let's hope we left the place in safe hands. You won't be sorry to see it again?
No, not at all. I never really wanted to leave.
But you felt you had to?
Because my mother was too old, and I hoped we might do some good, make some discoveries.
You found the reason, Vazin said. That has to count for something.
And now we've lost most of them again.
Then we should be especially grateful for the five left to us. I was about to say in our care, but that doesn't quite sound right. They really don't need that much from us, do they? They're our equals.
At least.
It would be good to bring one of them with us back to Crucible, even onwards to Earth, an ambassador.
Yes, Goma said. We spoke about that, but it has to be their decision. We can't force it on them.
No, Vazin agreed. There's been quite enough of that.
It was not that any of them had stopped thinking about the Watchkeeper, least of all Carnu. It followed them from Poseidon, and when Travertine entered orbit,
It too took up station around Orizon. It was not orbiting in any conventional sense, but turning at an equal angular speed with the starship, only at a much greater distance from the surface. The ship and the watchkeeper, like two dots on an invisible clock hand. It bothered them, hanging up there, its pine cone shape aimed down at them like a blunt dagger. But then, people had been troubled by the presence of the watchkeepers for a very long time, in all the systems where humans had left their mark. There was only so much mental energy available for worrying about them. Mortals could not dwell on the affairs of gods for the whole of the day. But in the morning, the watchkeeper left its station. It descended down past Travertine's orbit, paying the ship no heed, and then lowered itself to within a scant kilometre of Orizon's surface. It hung there, an object the size of a small continent, massing the equivalent of 10,000 Zanzibars, yet stirring not a grain of dust below. In the airlessness of Orizon, the watchkeeper was as silent and wrong as a single thundercloud in an otherwise clear sky. Its black facets were partially open, allowing fans and blades of blue light to push out from its core. The watchkeeper was hundreds of kilometers wide near its blunt tail, the part currently pointing back into space, but its sharp end, almost touching Orizon, diminished down through layers of concentric rotating machinery to a scale that was almost within the bounds of human conception. That last kilometre of it was a kind of elephant's trunk, a thing that corkscrewed and probed. The trunk lingered above Eunice's camp. It touched nothing, but showed fleeting interest in the lander, the antennas, the glassed-over chambers where she grew her food, the curious stone kilns of the risen burial mounds. The humans and risen could only watch. The impulse was to go deeper into the warrens of the encampment. But how deep was deep enough when a watchkeeper was involved? Besides, they needed to know their fate. It was impossible to pull away from the windows, impossible to think about anything other than that looming alien presence. What did it want with them? What did it want specifically here and specifically now? An alarm sounded. An airlock was activating. The momentary fear was that something was trying to get in, but a second's reflection showed how absurd that was. The watchkeeper could have peeled back Orizon's crust like a scab, if it cared to do so. No, that alarm was someone going out, not coming in. "Where's Kanu?" Goma asked. No one had seen him for some while. He was nearly under the proboscis when she found the right channel on her suit.
"Kanu! It's Goma! What are you doing?"
He walked on for a few paces more, as if he had not heard her. Then he slowed, cast a glance back over his shoulder, light catching the edge of his visor, a hint of his too familiar profile behind the glass.
"Doing what an ambassador ought to do, Goma. Establishing diplomatic relations. It wants something. One of us, maybe. Well, I think I'm the obvious candidate."
"I lost Mpozi. I lost Eunice. I won't lose you."
"We've all lost more than our share, Goma. But I came to this system to learn something about them. In a way, I'm glad the choice has been so easily made for me. I don't think I'd have had the courage to go out into space and meet one, but this, it simplifies things a great deal. Wouldn't you agree?"
"Is it you talking, Kanu, or Swift?"
He sounded amused, curious, in equal measure.
"Does it matter?"
"I'd like to know. I'd like to know if it's a man making this decision or a machine making it for him."
"Oh, it's very much the man. Swift is here and we both know what must be done, but the choice is mine. The life is mine."
"You're only doing this because you've given up on Nyssa, but the rest of us haven't."
"Nyssa died, Goma. Taking her back home won't change that. Besides, where is home for me now? I can't go back to Mars, and Earth considers me a traitor to my own species.
For all you know, no one even remembers what you did by now.
No one remembers anything. In the end.
The proboscis had begun to concentrate its darting, twisting movements in the space immediately above Kanu. Only a few hundred meters separated them now. Kanu had even stopped walking, sensing the inevitable. He let his arms dangle at his sides, assuming a position of patient submission. It was on him like a striking snake. There was no whip crack, no shockwave, but the suddenness of the movement still left Goma stunned, almost falling back with the surprise of it. Nothing made of solid matter ought to move like that. Kanu was gone. The proboscis was withdrawing, telescoping back into that larger, looming mass. At the same time, the watchkeeper's entire body was rising back into space. Numbed by what she had seen, it was all Goma could do to keep breathing. She felt that to move, to utter a word, to allow herself one unwise thought, would be enough to provoke the watchkeeper to take her as well. She risked moving her head and looked up, tracking the watchkeeper's ascent. It was growing smaller. She wondered exactly what she had just witnessed, and whether witnessing it would be a blessing or a curse on the rest of her life. Hours passed, and the watchkeeper did not return. They tracked its departure, first via the ramshackle instruments and sensors of Eunice's camp, and then with the keener eyes and ears of their orbiting ship. The watchkeeper was speeding back out to the margins of the system, where others of its kind, those that had not been damaged or destroyed by Poseidon, were presumably still waiting. Goma could not help but feel that they were all in a state of judicial abeyance, waiting the deliverance of some terrible, irreversible verdict. It was hard to sleep, hard to think of anything else. She wondered what had become of Kanu, whether in any sense Kanu was still a living entity. It would have been good to speak with Ndege and find out what she in turn had learned from her mother during Chiku's own time inside the watchkeeper. She did not have Ndege. She did not have Mpozi or Kanu. She could not even speak to Nissa, the only other human being who had endured the terror and knew something of its qualities.
"If it intended to harm us," Grave said, "I think we would already know it. It had every chance to attack when it took Kanu. It must have sensed us nearby, in the camp aboard the ship, but it chose not to use destructive force."
"And if Kanu hadn't gone out there?" Rue asked.
Grave looked down.
"I don't know."
The three of them were seated around one of Eunice's tables. Since the burial ceremony, Goma and Rue had been spending a lot of time with the surviving Tantors in the lower levels of the camp. But it was necessary also to allow Orizon's Risen to get to know the sole survivor of Zanzibar's Risen expedition, and human beings were an undesirable complication during that process.
"Not like you, not to be sure of something," Rue said. "I thought it was all about certainty where second chances are concerned."
There was only gentle needling in her question, and Grave took no visible offense.
"If only, Rue. Funnily enough, nothing in Second Chance of Philosophy prepared me for this situation. Being on Orizon, waiting to hear what an implacable alien machine makes of our human envoy, who just happens to be carrying the hopes of the Martian machines with him."
"We are all in the same boat, then," Goma said.
"Do you think he'd have done what he did if Nissa were still alive?"
Rue looked sharply at him.
"You think it was suicide?"
"I don't know him well enough to say for sure, but it looked like the act of a man who had run out of hope."
"You can't blame him," Goma said. "First the terror, then the loss of his wife. None of us is in a position to judge Kanu for that."
"Believe me, judgment is the last thing on my mind.
Grave said.
I just wished he'd had more time to come to terms with his experiences. I think he would have had the strength to make peace with them, had they not all happened at once.
Easy for you to say, not having been through the terror,
Gomez said.
None of us went through it, Grave answered, but at the end of it all, we'd each and every one of us have been free to reject its message.
Rue made a skeptical face.
You mean deny it?
If denial is the mental strategy that allows life to be faced, so be it. Death is negation. Denial is better than that, under any circumstances. Besides, we have no objective evidence that the terror is anything other than a psychological weapon, a set of apparent propositions that only feel persuasive because they're being drilled into our minds at a very deep level like some kind of insidious propaganda.
We don't need the terror to tell us the message. We've got the wheels for that. The mandala grammar lays out the same truth. The vacuum will collapse. There's no arguing with that.
May collapse, Grave stated. But their physics might be wrong. Have you considered that possibility?
Goma shook her head. They had millions of years to find a flaw in it. If there was one, they'd have found it.
That's almost a position of faith, though, isn't it? By accepting unquestioningly that there was no error in the M-Builder's logic, you're placing them on the level of gods. But they were not infallible. We've seen the evidence of that for ourselves.
Have we?
Goma asked.
Poseidon is ruthless, but it is also indiscriminate. And these mandalas, a dangerous, powerful technology allowed to fall fallow? If they were gods, they were reckless, careless ones. Slipshod deities. They left us some lethal ruins. Ask the citizens of Zanzibar. Ask your mother.
My mother is dead.
I am sorry, but the point stands. I don't see infallibility in the M-Builder's work, Goma. I see arrogance, a blindness to their own flaws. Knowing that, how can we have the slightest confidence in their prophecies?
They are not prophecies. They're predictions.
Grave nodded solemnly, as if some great and subtle truth had been laid out before him.
Nonetheless, this might just as easily be a delusion they talk themselves into, a kind of species-level psychosis. Why should we be bound by that?
If you understood the physics, Goma began.
Do you? It isn't your native discipline any more than it's mine. Everything you believe, you know, was filtered through Eunice's understanding.
That was enough for me to get it.
But Eunice didn't take it into her heart, did she? If she had, if she truly accepted the M-Builder's gospel, that all acts are futile, that there's no point in any deed, any gesture, then she wouldn't have given up her own life to save Ruth. That was an act born of kindness and empathy, not despair.
We can't know what was in her head, Goma said.
But we can do her the honor of recognizing that her sacrifice had meaning, that it was more than an empty gesture. With that one kind act, she repudiated every word the M-Builders ever wrote. Their truth was theirs to live with. We don't have to.
That's starting to sound like another article of faith, Rue said.
So be it. Both of you came here seeking knowledge. It's been the arrow of your lives to know the world. Physics is one path. You chose to study the minds of other creatures. But that quest for meaning, for what you think of as truth, has only brought you to this. Doubt, despair, a crisis of belief in anything.
The truth hurts, Goma said. But it's still the truth.
You need to find a way through it in that case. Truth isn't the end, Goma. It's just a door. There's always another door beyond it, too. Endlessly and forever. The M-Builders may not have realized that, but you don't have to fall into the same trap. Both of you have work to do, here and on Crucible.
He gave an easygoing shrug.
On Earth, too, for all I know. The hard times aren't over yet. They may not even have begun, but we'll need good, strong people to face them.
You ask me about faith?
I have faith in us. in our capabilities, our ultimate capacity to make the right choices, people and reason, people and machines, all of us. But the worst thing of all would be to start doubting ourselves.
Kanu came back to them 3 days later. The Watchkeeper returned to its former position, circling Orizon in a higher orbit than Travertine's. For several hours there was no clear change in its disposition. Nothing to show, presuming Kanu still existed in any meaningful sense, that it held a human being within itself. Goma debated consulting the records aboard the ship, to refresh her memory as to what happened under similar circumstances when Chiku Green was taken into one of those machines. But the circumstances were only similar up to a point. Kanu was not Chiku, and this world was not Crucible. It came in just as quickly as the first time, and the focus of his interest was the same patch of ground where Kanu had waited. The proboscis made a darting strike at the surface, and when it retreated, leaving only a curl of dust, there was a space-suited human form, on his knees, hands at his sides. Goma put on her own suit as soon as the Watchkeeper began to close in. She was in the lock, and waiting. She rushed to him, found their common channel. The lights on his suit were all in the green, and she could see the fogging and unfogging of his breath on the inner surface of his faceplate.
Kanu, talk to me.
He stirred. He turned his face towards her. He opened his eyes, blinked, appeared at first to struggle with focus.
Goma.
Yes, I'm here. Are you all right?
Yes.
But then he paused. A moment of quiet consideration followed, as if her questions merited the most sincere answers he could give.
I think so, anyway.
Kanu, you were inside the Watchkeeper for 3 whole days. Do you remember any of it?
3 days?
Yes.
It didn't feel like 3 days. 3 years, maybe. 3 decades. Something strange happened to me, Goma. I'm not quite sure what.
Then he reached out a hand, and she helped him stand, unsteadily at first but appearing to find his strength by the second.
Something strange, he repeated. We were inside them. We were trying to make them understand.
Understand what?
What they used to be. What they ceased to be. What they could be again.
I don't follow.
The Gupta Wing Threshold. Ask Chiku. Swift told them. Swift made them see. He understood it better than I ever did.
His words meant nothing to her, except for the mention of Chiku.
Kanu, is Swift still in your head?
No. Swift's with them now. They took him but left me behind.
With a certain resignation, he added,
they are done with me now.
Swift's in that Watchkeeper?
In all of them. He's propagating between them, like an idea they can't help but spread. They were blind to the Gupta Wing theorem, and once they'd crossed the threshold, they had no reason to doubt themselves. But Swift is giving them reason to question what they are.
It sounded like babble, but she thought it unlikely that Kanu Akinya would be spouting nonsense for the sake of it. She took his elbow and helped him back to the camp.
Simplify it for me. I work with elephants, not machines. Is this a good thing or a bad thing?
We'll have to see. That's all. Like everything else. Has it really been only 3 days, Goma?
Would I lie to you, Uncle?
He stumbled on a pebble. She caught him before any harm was done.
Watch your step, Ambassador.
Oh, I'm not the Ambassador now. I leave that to my friend.
Then what are you?
A man still hoping to find some useful purpose in life. If it lets him. If he hasn't worn out, he's welcome.
You have one useful thing to do?
You have one useful thing to do.
The directness of her statement drew a laugh. Do I?
Yes. You're coming back to Crucible with me. With Nyssa. If they can help on Crucible, so be it. Otherwise, we'll carry on to Earth. You know that planet, and I'm going to need a guide when I get there.
Someone to keep you out of trouble. I may not be best qualified for that. Anyway, Earth will be very strange even to me when we get back.
Have you been to Africa, Kanu?
Once or twice.
Will it still be there?
Barring the frankly improbable, yes, I suppose. It ought to be.
Then you can take me to Kilimanjaro. I have Eunice's heart.
Only her heart?
The rest of her stays here, with the written.
Gomer risked a glance back over her shoulder, into the emptying sky.
Do you think the Watchkeeper will be coming back?
Not for a little while. I have some thinking to do.
Then we'll need to move ahead with the funeral arrangements. Kanu, are you going to be all right? You've lost Nyssa, now Swift. And then whatever happened to you in there...
I'll cope, Goma. When you've already died once, coping becomes second nature.
I think you might have died a second time.
3 times, if you include the terror. I'll try not to make a habit of it.
Please don't, Goma said.
It fell to Goma to lead the human party. It was a smaller cairn this time, for the body was that of a human woman, not one of the Risen. The Risen had done the hard work of shaping the cairn with large stones of various shapes. They took great deliberation in the selection of these pieces. And when they were set into the cairn, they appeared to interlock with uncanny neatness, as if they were the shattered pieces of some once unified whole. For the humans, it remained only to select their own smaller stones and fill in the gaps. They took pains not to upset the work that had already been done.
For Eunice,
Goma said, placing one fist-shaped stone onto the cairn.
May these stones bind the thread of her memories with those who have already passed into the remembering. May they bind her to the promise of the black sky she craved, and to the memory of the blue earth she never stopped loving. Her name was Eunice Akinya, and her blood is my blood. They called her Senge Dongma, the lion-faced one. And I will bring this lion's heart back to the place she knew as a child.
The stone was set. Goma turned from the cairn. Overhead, one by one, the watchkeepers were dimming their blue lights to the lowest possible state of radiance. It was an accident of timing, nothing more. They were concentrating their mental resources on the vexing question of this odd and troubling mathematical theorem. At times like these, when a difficult matter required pondering, they had learned that it was wiser to assign separate streams of mentation to each watchkeeper, each tackling the problem as a whole, rather than dividing it into fragments that could be processed among their dispersed elements, but with no one watchkeeper grasping the entirety of the problem. That way, when answers tallied, they could view the results as significant. The watchkeepers had indulged in this kind of deep meditation before, and they were quite prepared to take their time over it. These busy, buzzing humans had been a local distraction, and they were entertaining enough in their way, but it would be better when they moved on, and some silence had returned to this corner of creation. The shutters of their scales closed. The blue lights dimmed to the darkest shade of blue that is not black. The watchkeepers settled down to dwell on what they were. Kanu Akinya, turning from the cairn after setting his own stone in place, thought he glimpsed an old friend out of the corner of his eye. In a single fluid movement, The figure raised a hand, touched a finger to his pince-nez, smiled a fond farewell, and then was gone forever.